Case number 15-7128 et al. Joshua Fuller et al. Wayne Nelson, appellant. Gerald Burton et al. Versus District of Columbia. Mr. Burton for appellant Burton. Mr. Nelson for appellant Nelson. Ms. Rucker for appellant Rayford et al. Mr. Temple for appellant Addo. And Ms. Johnson for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gerald Burton. I respectfully request to reserve 30 seconds for rebuttal. The trial judge got it wrong by stepping over the facts during summary judgment. Stating that I was not a proper comparator to the other individuals is not true. Page 464B in Article 1 states that all sworn employees through the rank of captain are covered under the CBA and treated the same. The statement not only advanced one sergeant is incorrect, I showed at least two, page 1793, 1794, 1829, and 1831. The court also got it wrong about the overtime. On page 1765, 1766, it shows the other member working overtime in the same pay period. I mentioned the Wayne case. It refused to even consider evidence of employee wrongdoing. Specifically, it ignored the agency's decision that Wayne had performed below the agency's legitimate expectation. I referenced the Maestro case. The court should not grant summary judgment because the reasonable jury could have concluded the agency's assessment of the case was an inquiry colored by discrimination. In fact, the circuit court just recently reiterated that whether the two employees who are similarly situated is ordinarily a question for fact for the jury, White citing Wheeler at 812 F3. If all the compared evidence failed, the case was not doomed. This very court, the Court of Appeals in the Wayne case. For all the reasons I've stated above, the summary judgment should be reversed and remanded.
Thank you, Mr. Burton.
Good morning. I respectfully request 30 seconds for rebuttal. I've been a firefighter for 31 years. In those 31 years, dealing with this case has been one of the hardest things I've had to deal with. The court, in the summary judgment, erred when it did not consider all the facts of my case. Number one, the fact that an African-American captain, as stated in my brief on page 14, who was sequestered on the test writing committee, was terminated when those tests were African-American top-heavy. And that exam was thrown out. And in my case, a Caucasian captain who violated the sequester, Joint Appendix page 450 through 452, was briefly demoted and reinstated when those lists were top-heavy Caucasian, and that exam was allowed to go forward. Joint Appendix 453 through 456. None of the facts, the changing of the testing procedures, the deviations, Joint Appendix 1710 through 11, the violation of the sequester, or the pattern of discrimination, as evidenced by the massive Joint Appendix, was taken into consideration by the court's decision. As stated in the case of Brady versus Officer Sergeant, a plaintiff has multiple ways to cast doubt on an employer's assertion for reason but acting, such as an African-American captain in violation being terminated and a test thrown out, and a Caucasian captain in violation being briefly reprimanded, reinstated, and a test moving forward, Joint Appendix 450 and 1649. It is not fair that the facts weren't given any value. Number two, there were many errors stated by the court. The court even stated in Joint Appendix 1224, it was difficult in trying to organize the plaintiffs, and this difficulty caused errors. For example, the court gave a statistical breakdown for the captain exam, but not myself, Joint Appendix 1300. If a jury were to see the statistical breakdown of myself and the agency's own admission of discrimination, Joint Appendix 633 to 654 and 1683, a jury would give summary judgment to me. Number three, the agency changed the promotion exam mid-testing, see my reply brief page 3 in Joint Appendix 342. The change was done when we used candidate ID numbers. The candidate ID numbers would keep everyone anonymous, but the change was to put us and make us have write our names on the test. This fact was not appreciated by the court. This change allowed the agency to identify Caucasian members for promotion, Joint Appendix 1971 through 2015. As stated in Bruce Smith versus Boston, the court would consider all factors, promotion rates, pass-fail rates, average scores, and delays of promotion. Case law is on my side. As in the case of the Vogue Society versus New York, this proves that widespread discrimination still exists. And per the reasons stated, the court's decision must be reversed and summary judgment must be granted to myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Good morning, Your Honors. I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. For the record, my name is Donna Rucker, and I represent three of the appellants in this case, Mr. Charles Florence, Mr. Daniel Botts, and Mr. Charles Rayford, who has filed this appeal because the trial court erred in granting summary judgment with respect to the specific claims. For purposes of this appeal, we rest upon the record that has been provided with respect to the briefs submitted, as well as to the deferred joint appendix and the supplemented deferred appendix. We assert, however, that the trial court erred for three basic reasons. When you look at the evidence of record and take into consideration the record as a whole, it is clear, when viewed in a light most favorable to the appellants, the trial court erred in making a determination that there was no existence of evidence to support an inference of discrimination based upon race. With respect to the particular appellant, Florence, the record is clear that, I'll call him Appellant Florence, in this particular case, had been subjected to a trial board hearing as a result of an alleged claim of discrimination for sexual harassment. The record in this case shows that we provided a comparator who is a white male who, subsequent to the charges by Mr. Florence, actually was charged as well. However, in this case, if you look at the charges from the department for this particular event, which we allege would be more egregious, you don't have any mention of any violation of the D.C. Human Rights Act. That is pivotal. In this particular case with the appellant Florence, the decision by the board was never officially issued. However, he was secreted in terms of being called by Chief Brian Lee to come to a meeting to discuss the impending presentation of a decision by the board. What is, I think, relevant, Your Honors, with respect to Lieutenant Florence is that the court erred in making a determination that this particular white male, who was also a lieutenant, was not a proper comparator. Whether or not this person was a proper comparator, first of all, is evidence that should have been determined by a jury, because there is evidence that exists that they were similarly situated. You look specifically to the nature of the offense as well as the penalty in this particular place. Notwithstanding the fact that we would argue, did not have evidence that would have warranted a violation of the D.C. Human Rights Act. We can't go back and relitigate the trial board, but we can point out for evidence of pretext as well as evidence existing to infer discrimination that the decision to not have this particular white lieutenant determined to have been in violation of the D.C. Human Rights Act was very important. As a matter of fact, as this record shows, when the lieutenant was told by the assistant chief that he would, in fact, face difficulty in working with others and that it was in his best interest to retire, he took that advice, and therefore it is our position that this was a coerced resignation and therefore a termination and an adverse action. With respect to the appellant Botts, what you find in this particular record is that the trial court erred in making a determination that Mr. Botts had not, in fact, properly asserted triable facts for the court, in that Mr. Botts had not presented any information pertaining to his national registry training requirements. However, on this particular record, it is clear that what the appellant is articulating here is somewhat misrepresented in the order that is presented by the judge, because there isn't an allegation that there was no requirement or that there was some exception that Mr. Botts was entitled to. What is argued in this particular case is that the National Registry training, once it became required for individuals, if you were hired before a particular point, it did not entitle the department to terminate you if you were not successful. So in this particular case, with respect to Appellant Botts, what we're saying is if you decided that because of this new implementation that you want to have everyone go to the training academy, you should have had African Americans and you should have had Caucasians present as well. So the discrimination in this particular case is not in asking Appellant Botts to attend the training for the National Registry. It is being selective and the disparate treatment that went into making a decision as to who would attend. We also argue that the court's analysis about whether or not there was, in fact, adverse action is misplaced, given the fact that on this record, the district clearly argued for what would be purported to be legitimate non-discriminatory reasons for its actions. And therefore, the question is whether or not there's evidence of pretext. We believe on this record, with the presentation of the specific individuals who were identified by Appellant Botts, in terms of who should have been at the training academy, the impact of the fact that he was there, which is loss of holiday pay, loss of overtime opportunity, loss of the ability to take a promotional exam. We have both prima facie evidence as well as evidence of pretext.
Was his evidence that there was disparate treatment that he saw that there were no whites there?
That is correct, Your Honor. Mr. Botch testified to that, and that goes to another point that is at issue in this particular case when the judge concluded that his deposition testimony should not be credited. It is clear that deposition testimony is evidence that should have been considered by the court, and in looking at what was provided in this record in a light most favorable to Mr. Botts, he in fact should have been allowed to have his claims go forward. With respect to Mr. Rayford, there are two actions that he is talking about in his case. Specifically, Mr. Rayford is saying that with respect to his suspension, the record is clear that acts and events such as minor traffic offenses would be normally dealt with at a battalion chief's conference. The discrimination, what we are alleging in terms of disparate treatment here, is the fact that as it pertains to him, his matter went directly to a trial board. This is the evidence that exists with respect to the disparity report that's contained in this record, showing that there's an 80% plus disparity, which changes over time, but never diminishes or eliminates the fact that there is disparity in treatment with African Americans who are facing discipline within the DC Fire and EMS Department. With Mr. Rayford, he points out with respect to his suspension that there were many others. He talks in this record about the fact that there is a record that he observed where there were others who had similar minor offenses, but others with more severe offenses, yet their penalty would be a reprimand or counseling. With respect to his termination, while it is true that he failed the drug treatment program, the judge erred in deciding that he did not have an adverse action because of his resignation. Mr. Rayford, in this particular case, his argument is specifically that he didn't have the opportunity, as others, to not be in the program. I see my time has ended. I reserve for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Donald Tupp, and I represent Appellate Adu. In this brief 2 minutes, I want to go straight to the issue of Mr. Adu's argument. And number one, I'd like to direct the court's attention to the lower court judge's footnote 17, where the court essentially minimized and negated the most compelling piece of evidence in this case, which is the chart that was submitted by the plaintiffs below, which indicated an 80% disparate treatment in terms of the disciplinary actions taken by, admittedly submitted by the fire department at a city council, in a city council meeting and presentation, that shows that African Americans are institutionally treated relative to discipline six times more egregiously in terms of the punishments issued towards versus whites. And pertinent to Mr. Adu, as an anecdote, Mr. Adu, who missed three medical appointments, was suspended in each instance. Whereas white comparators who had not submitted to these medical examinations.
But were any of them similarly situated to him?
Well, they were arguably similarly situated to this extent, to the extent that the policy at issue was universal.
Why was he supposed to be going to the doctor?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why was he supposed to be going to the medical appointment?
These are the annual reviews.
You're fine.
That's correct. These are the annual.
It wasn't just an annual in his case, was it?
The three were annual.
The other three were, and he wasn't. He was a claimant, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He was a claimant at that time, was he not?
Yes, he was.
And they were annuals, right?
They were
annual fitnesses, right?
No, his were also annual fitnesses.
I thought his was for his claim.
No, Your Honor, they were fitness claims. Fitness for duty claims. They were part of the 103. We referred to that 103 in the deferred joint appendix, where he was also required to go for annual reviews, similar to those other captains.
Similar. Your concept of similar is pretty broad, I think, yeah.
Well, the court, with all due respect, the policy, and understanding the framework of the law, but the policy says that all, and we point to the joint deferred appendix, all of these employees are required to have these annual fitness reviews. So to the extent that they're all required, they are all, transcends the ranks of these employees. Additionally, the inference here and the issue here relative to the institutional discrimination here is there is the court minimized the significance, evidentiary significance of that in her analysis. To the extent that you have the statistical chart, which is part of a government document, we believe that the basis would have existed at trial for it to be self-authenticated with the proper certification. The court suggests that Mr. Lee, who was not part of the evidentiary submission to the city council, didn't recognize the document, is of no evidentiary moment because he was not the person. It was the chief himself who presented this particular evidence to the city council. The statistics, the point being here in the limited time that I have, which is that that statistical chart, if it were given the proper evidentiary significance, along with Mr. Adu's anecdotal comparisons, which we point out on pages 4 and 5 of our brief, along with the other evidentiary issues in terms of discrimination against Mr. Adu, would have resulted, we think, in a triable issue where a jury, not a judge, should have made this particular decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Morning. May it please the court, Holly Johnson for the District of Columbia. After 4 years of discovery and thousands of documents produced, a bunch of depositions, none of the six plaintiffs have been able to muster sufficient evidence to raise a question of fact with regard to discrimination in their particular case. I'm going to start, because we have six different claims, I'm going to start with the disciplinary cases and then move on to the others, unless this court wants me to start in a different place. Let's start with Mr. Adu, since that's where we started, that's where we left off. As this court has mentioned, of course, there was different conduct for the comparator. Mr. Adu was injured. He was on administrative leave, which meant he was getting paid to sit at home and heal. And he had scheduled clinic appointments, which means time was set aside for him. He missed those appointments, so the conduct was different.
So but, I was not missing something. It is the case that his was a different kind of scheduling than the annual review.
Absolutely. It's as opposed to a failure to schedule. But also important, his Caucasian comparators were penalized more harshly than he was. He was penalized for 12 hours for missing one clinic appointment, and then when he missed two more within the next 6 weeks, he was given another 24-hour suspension. The comparators were given 300-hour suspensions. So even if they were comparable misconduct, they were penalized more severely. Finally, with regard to Mr. Adu, it's important to note that the record demonstrates this first missed appointment was his fifth neglect of duty type charge in 3 years. So he is not established, regardless of whether the department had an institutional issue with disparate statistics in regard to discipline, he is not established that he personally suffered disparate treatment with regard to discipline. Moving on to Mr. Florence. Mr. Florence had different decision makers propose his demotion and suspension than those that proposed the demotion of his comparator.
Why does that matter?
Well, it's critically important because the reason why the trial court was tolerant of the different decision makers with all of the other disciplinary actions is because the decision finally at the end went to the fire chief. And if you look at the record, a lot of these suspensions that were proposed were cut down by the fire chief. So that was the final decision maker. Here, because he did not pursue an appeal with the fire chief, we don't know what the final decision would have meant. And it's entirely possible the fire chief, first of all, would have believed him instead of believing his accuser. It was a he said, she said situation. Or the fire chief might have said, oh, well, this other guy was just demoted and not suspended, so I'm just going to demote you and I'm going to reverse the suspension. So that's important.
But it doesn't make it any less disparate.
It does a bit. But
are
the
you
question,
arguing a failure to exhaust?
No, not at all.
Right,
well,
so then all we
indeed,
have
yes,
is,
we are arguing a failure to exhaust, but that's a separate
all
argument.
All you have is the comparison, and the comparisons don't look good for you.
Well, the reason why the different decision makers is considered a key factor in looking at similarly situated employees is that the question is not whether he was treated differently than someone of another race in general. This is not a disparate impact case. The question is whether there was intentional discrimination. And if you want to get into the mind of the decision maker, if you have different decision makers, they may see sexual harassment with different severity. They may not have even known about the other fact, the other case. But even if they did, they might have seen, maybe they thought the
so
other case was
So you're saying the city can have a disciplinary system that results in whimsical decision-making and can never be called on it merely because they're different boards?
Absolutely not.
Well,
there is an appeal.
Bottom line with Florence and the comparators is they're quite different.
Yes. Well, I will say, first of all, there are other reasons why Florence doesn't have a claim. But with regard to the similarly situated factors, of course, there's a whole Office of Employee Appeals process to determine that the termination or that the discipline was fair, that it was appropriate. But the question here is intentional racial discrimination. And when it comes to that, the Good case, the Seventh Circuit, has a really nice description of why all of these circumstances need to line up, and that is to eliminate other possible explanatory variables. For example, different decision makers, which helps isolate the critical independent variable, which is discriminatory animus. But I will also note, of course, there's also a failure to exhaust issue here, because Mr. Florence did not suffer an adverse action. He retired before the trial board's decision even was formally issued. His chief called him in, said, trial board's about to issue this decision. You have some choices to make, and he chose to voluntarily retire. He's shown no case where someone voluntarily retiring in lieu of a proposed demotion where he didn't even appeal to the chief somehow has an adverse action. Again, he may well have won if he'd gone to the chief.
Well, if the chief is encouraging to him to retire, why would he think he was going to win?
I apologize. There's the fire chief, that's the big chief, and then there's the assistant chief, and you refer to them as Chief Lee. But it was an assistant chief. It was a lower-level official that was speaking to him. We're not talking about an appeal to the final chief. Those are completely different people. And, in fact, the chief gave him an option and didn't pressure him to retire.
This chief is the assistant chief.
Yes, assistant chief Lee is the one that met with him. The ultimate fire chief head of the agency is the one that makes the final decision.
Unless you're something other than the chief, if you're not talking about
that. I apologize. You're correct. That is a shorthand that definitely confuses the matters here. So Mr. Florence didn't suffer an adverse action. Even if he did, he has not shown that it was due to any sort of discrimination, intentional discrimination particular to him. As to Mr. Burton, he has not shown that there is any comparator who engaged in the same sort of misconduct he engaged in. And, in fact, the trial board directly addressed this comparator, because he raised the comparator before the trial board, and they said that the comparator, K.A., all he did was respond undispatched. He saw a fire, he responded, and then he informed the dispatch that he was doing so. In comparison, Mr. Burton forced the reorganization of a fire ground that had already been planned out by dispatching himself after he was directly ordered not to dispatch. And then after that, he did not follow standard operating procedures and, according to the trial board, created a dangerous situation. None of these factors are there for his comparator. And then, indeed, the trial board noted also that Mr. Burton afterward refused to take responsibility, which meant he didn't learn from the problem. And that's very different from his comparator, who apologized and said he would do things differently the next time. I do want to briefly address this question of whether Mr. Burton whether another comparator was allowed to do overtime work while he was suspended. If the court looks at JA 1768 and 1769, those are the two pages that indicate the 2 weeks when comparator JF was suspended. And on those two pages, there is not a dot of overtime served. He served overtime before his suspension. He served overtime after his suspension, but not during. And even if you look at the very end of the suspension, it looks like the very last day of that suspension, he split his shift, which meant he was suspended for half of it and he worked the second half of it. So that pretty much just answers that question. All right, one more disciplinary, and I will move on. Mr. Rayford had two different disciplinary actions. The first was suspension for getting into an accident while he was not carrying his driver's license, after he had misled his supervisor into believing that he was carrying his driver's license. The record indicates that if he told his supervisor, "I don't know where my driver's license is," his supervisor would have just put someone else in the driver's seat. None of the comparators that he offers have any of these factors relevant, or none of them are in the record at all. And indeed, he, as the district court noted, cherry-picked So the Caucasians who'd been in accidents and were only reprimanded, I believe there were six of those. Well, there were 11 African-American firefighters who'd been in accidents that were also reprimanded. So there's simply no evidence of discriminatory animus here. I will also note that the trial court there gave him an enhanced penalty because of his disciplinary record. We don't have the disciplinary record of the comparators. Now let's move on to his more pertinent claim, his claim regarding his termination. Now he was terminated for two different types of misconduct. Number one, which was the automatic termination, for testing positive for marijuana while he was in the substance abuse program. And there is no evidence that any other comparator tested positive for an illegal drug while in the substance abuse program. We know that one other comparator had a previous violation of the policy, but we don't know when that was. We don't know if he was in the substance abuse program. More importantly, Mr. Rayford was also terminated for tampering with his urine sample, for attempting to falsify his drug test results, and he doesn't even mention that in his briefs. So, again, there's no evidence of disciplinary action, disparate disciplinary action there. I'm going to take a breath and move on to the issues that have been raised by Mr. Nelson and Mr. Botts. Mr. Nelson had concerns about the promotional exam, and he primarily focuses on this violation of a sequester. The important fact in the evidence is that the individual who violated the sequester was not actually a test writer. He was a member of the subject matter expert panel. And according to the policy, that panel was to, after all the test questions were written, then they were given the test questions and they weighted them in a way that created a fair ranking weighting of points for the scores. So there's an affidavit in the record, which is cited in my brief, which indicates that at the time that he notified the department he violated the sequester and was removed from the team, he had never had access to the exam. It had not been written yet. So that violation of the sequester could not have had any impact on the exam. Now, there was somebody in 2000, a African-American member of the test writing team, who not only violated the sequester, he created a cheat sheet and handed it out to the African-American members of his team because he wanted them to do better on the test. And indeed, he was terminated and the test was canceled at that time. That has nothing to do with what happened here. It has nothing to do with claims of intentional race discrimination. And finally, with regard to Mr. Botts and the EMT training, regardless of what Mr. Botts saw while he was at the training center, and he was not there the entire time the training center was open, by December 2010, nearly every employee in the department was certified. Well, half of the department is Caucasian. So either they obtained their certification elsewhere, and there's nothing discriminatory about that, or they were already certified, or they were at the training center at various times. There certainly was no discriminatory application of...
You're saying nearly everyone. What about the whites who were not, and... His claim is he was made to go, and they were not.
Well, his claim is that they were, that I don't know whether there were a few people left over who hadn't been certified by December 2010.
But how can you gloss over that? That's his claim. We're talking about a dismissal, summary judgment if they're contested facts.
If he
hasn't raised enough?
No, because he hasn't shown...
What does he have to do? He doesn't have the department records. What else should he have
done? Well, he does have the department records. There were 4 years of discovery. All of this information was available to him. He had every opportunity. And he certainly hasn't shown that the handful of people that weren't certified were all Caucasian. What we know is that there were a few people who were still left off at the time that the records, the record at least doesn't demonstrate that, that almost everyone was certified. All of his evidence that Caucasians were not required to satisfy the standard, all of it is hearsay. And in his reply brief, he says...
But what do you mean hearsay?
His
observations
hearsay? It is his personal testimony at deposition that someone told him...
There is some of that, but there is also his testimony that he was at training sessions and made the claim that there were no whites there.
Yes, that is the only evidence he has that whites were not required.
It's evidence.
They were certified. The Caucasian members were certified too.
Did the city show that in response?
Yes. The city has produced its records. It's produced all of these records. Everyone has been certified. There might be a handful that weren't, but it's certainly, there's no evidence that that has some sort of racial breakdown. Yes, everyone was certified. Everyone was required to do this. He heard people.
Don't keep saying everyone because you just got finished saying it wasn't everyone.
Certainly, but a jury would have to speculate on this evidence to find that the fact that a handful of unspecified as far as to race.
As far as we know, they were all African American.
As far as we know, we just don't know. And the plaintiffs have the burden of proof here.
They have the burden, right?
They have the burden of proof here, and there's no evidence of discriminatory animus. I see my time is almost up. I do want to mention, with regard to both the promotional exam, the EMT training, and the hostile work environment claims, that the plaintiffs have made no effort to argue or satisfy the Monell requirement to show that the district had a policy or custom. Of course, the concerning statistics regarding racial disparity in discipline satisfy, at least for purpose of summary judgment, Monell with regard to the discipline cases. But with regard to the promotional exam or the EMT training, there's no evidence of a custom or practice, and the employees are not challenging the policy itself. So for these reasons, after all of this...
How do you account for the report? How should that fit? I'm sorry for my voice, in the analysis.
Yeah, and indeed,
this is a city's report that bad things were going on.
Yes, and the plaintiffs are mistaken when they say that the district court discounted that report. And indeed, the district has not argued that that report is inadmissible or irrelevant. Those concerning numbers got the employees past their prima facie hurdle. It did, in fact, raise an inference of discrimination. But you can't have an individual discrimination claim without
presenting... No, I understand that. I'm just asking you what your thoughts are on the report, because it's a damning report.
Well, all I can work off of is the record, and indeed the numbers are concerning. And I'm working with the summary judgment record that I have. Had the plaintiffs pursued a class action claim or a policy or practice claim, there would have been more discovery done. There would have been experts. And all we have are the raw numbers at this point. For policy and practice cases, which look to resolve institutional or systemic problems with discrimination, then you bring in experts, and then we would bring in our own experts, and we would talk about what those numbers actually mean. There is one thing I would like to say about those numbers, because, of course, they're worrisome. But I would like to note that, contrary to what the plaintiffs claim in their reply brief, there is no evidence of disproportionate discipline for same or similar offenses. I believe that would be more troubling. There's evidence that there were more disciplinary actions taken against African Americans than Caucasians, and indeed that is concerning. But there's no evidence that that was done for the same or similar offenses.
Now, can I ask you, because I'm very curious about this too. It's a strange report, and it really is disturbing. But how do you know? How have you gotten at this idea of whether it's disparate for the same or similar offenses? In other words, are you saying there's no evidence because the plaintiffs here have not provided it?
That is exactly what I'm saying. I have not done independent research into this.
There could be evidence of that. It's just that we don't know.
It's not in the record.
It's not
exactly.
In the record.
Everything I'm dealing with here is with what's in the record. And because this case was brought, ended up being brought as individual discrimination cases, that really wasn't explored because the district was never going to contend in light of those reports that the plaintiffs hadn't satisfied their prima facie burden. So then it became an individualized inquiry, and it doesn't look like a lot of analysis was done in that area.
Thank you. Okay. let's see. Mr. Bergen, you had reserved 30 seconds, and also Mr. Nelson.
Your Honor, counsel got it wrong. Firegrounds are restructured all the time. I've been a member for 20-some years, and they're restructured. I'm faced with a citizen pointing to where the house is on fire. If had I not acted, I could see it. I'd be facing my, termination. I was forced to act. So, as counsel said, it wasn't, again, we'll move on. I didn't take responsibility because there was a process in place with our CBA. The city sent me to, the first thing was the deputies conference. The deputy's up here. He said, I'm not putting a man on the charges for putting out a fire. He sent me below. I went to the battalion conference. They sent me to the same charging official, who ran the fire ground, which is illegal. Then from there, they sent me to a trial board facing a termination. It's a violation of the city's own CBA that they agreed to. As far as the overtime, Counsel got it wrong again. The overtime, and again, let me be clear, it's on page 1768, 1766. We worked 2 weeks. In that two-week period, for the same pay period, he worked overtime while suspended. So the pages that the counsel's talking about, 1768, it's wrong. 1765 and 1766 are the two-week pay period. He worked while he was suspended. As far as the refuse to take responsibility, again, why am I going to take responsibility? There's a process. Our CBA is covered by it. I was forced to act for a citizen or for a visitor to the city. I'm looking at a house that's on fire. What do they want me to do?
Okay. We understand your argument.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Counsel got it wrong about the subject matter experts. The African-American captain that was terminated and the white captain, they were both on the subject matter writing committee, which means you have an independent company that writes an exam, but you have experts from the agency that have to give their materials about that specific agency. Both of these captains were on that committee. My argument is this. If any individual that's involved in the process has one bit of information, and if he gives that information to one person, it violates the whole process. So what happened in this case, there was a Caucasian captain who admittedly violated the process, and the agency allowed him to do that because the timeline that's in the joint appendix shows that the test process was in April. It didn't finish till July. The subject matter expert, the captain, the white captain, he wasn't charged until after August. The promotion list comes out on the 15th. I understand that I kicked the hornet's nest and that the AC had to cover that up. But the comparators between the black captain and the white captain, they both were on the same type of committee to give information for the test process. And the violation was clear and admitted by the agency, and the damage was done. One test was thrown out, one test was allowed to go forward. Through that massive joint appendix, there's clear evidence that the AC allowed this to happen to cover its own tracks. Because what I did would have created a massive change. But what's right is right. What's wrong is wrong. And I'm just saying the comparators are there, the evidence is there, and the mission of the agency is there. So I'm just saying that should be a jury's decision to make. The evidence is there. The changing of the test, the admitting of doing deposition of members in the fire department, that things weren't investigated when they were out there. All these things are in that joint appendix. As you can see, it's three phone book size. It's three phone book size. The department admitting of discrimination, not only for the disparity in treatment, but the systematic part of it. The part that means this. The part that means that I would just say this in closing. The sergeants and lieutenants of today become the captain and chiefs and policymakers of tomorrow. That's important. So to have that advantage to anybody is wrong. The process should be fair. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. All right. I think, had no time left. Okay. But
I had none.
You had none, but we will give you a moment, 1 minute at least, for rebuttal.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I want to address very quickly then the fact that with respect to Florence, I think counsel is confusing, again, the record with respect to how things work. With respect to Lieutenant Florence's trial board, once a trial board decision is concluded, that decision is processed administratively up to the fire chief, who then decides whether that decision will go forward. When Assistant Chief Lee met with Lieutenant Florence, it had already gone up to the fire chief, who had obviously approved it, which is why that discussion was occurring. So it's incorrect to say that was not a process that Lieutenant Florence used. Whether or not he had the right to appeal the ultimate decision of the trial board if he was terminated would have taken it outside of the fire department to the DC Department of Employee Appeals. It would not have even been reviewed by the DC Fire and EMS Department as to an incorrect termination. With respect to the allegation that with Rayford, What we are pointing out here is the distinction between the fact that Mr. Rayford was put into the drug treatment program, as our record shows, immediately upon testing positive. We have evidence in this record of white individuals who were driving under the influence, who were arrested for driving under the influence. Those individuals were not immediately inserted into the drug treatment program. The significance of that is, especially as to one, the second offense did not result in a termination, as it did with Mr. Rayford. This is the disparate treatment. So when you talk about you don't have anybody or any comparators with a similar record, that's because they're not being disciplined. We cannot stand before you and point out the specific and repeated violations because they're not being disciplined. That has the impact of having us have to stand here and say, Mr. Rayford may come to you with these two events, but the question and the point is, you can't have an individual, a probationer from the evidence in this record, who gets no chances when you violate a rule or procedure within the department, has a DUI, and is not fired. That is an injustice. That is the discrimination. With respect to Mr. Botts, the clear point that we're making here is that, as this court was saying, asking in terms of the questions to counsel, it is not correct that there's no evidence here that others were treated differently. It is absolutely correct that Mr. Botts pointed out in bringing this case specific individuals, Ayers, he indicated, who was not down at the program, Scahill. He also pointed out individuals, initials KC, JD, and DF. These are individuals. Counsel has told you that at some point or another, everyone was certified. Whether or not that is true has nothing to do with the discrimination that existed when Mr. Botts and others who are African-American were made to sit down at the national training for the national training, and they were not allowed to leave. They actually had penalties that existed, such as because they were down there, for example, Mr. Botts for 2 years, felt, okay, you can't fire him, that's the rule. Well, let's make it very uncomfortable. Let's start making him come every day of the week. And for anyone who's worked a shift where you work one and you're off three, that has a significant impact on life, on you. All I'm saying is with this particular record, it is not, as counsel has stated, that there is the absence or the lack of evidence in the record to show that there were specific individuals who were treated more favorably. That is in this record. It does exist, and it is evidence of discrimination. And a reasonable juror, had this case not been dismissed, a reasonable jury could have concluded and inferred racial discrimination. We ask that you reverse this matter and allow it to proceed on the merits.
Thank you, Ms. Rucker.
Based on what the district says, if the report can be admitted for purposes of...
Excuse me, counsel.
I'm sorry.
All right. So
but I have 1 minute.
We will give you also 1 minute.
1 minute. Thank you. Yeah. Based on what the district has stated, it has conceded that the statistical report could be admitted for purposes of establishing Monell. It's our contention that essentially this is a pretext case, and in particular to Mr. Adu, that along with the evidentiary significance and the inferences that it should be created in Mr. Adu and other plaintiffs' favor by virtue of that report. And I would just footnote, the problem with the report, and it's indicated in this record, is that the African Americans experience discipline disproportionately. The exponential implications and development of that discipline penalize them because the next discipline becomes more egregious and more egregious and more egregious. That could have been established at trial. The other point, though, with Mr. Adu, and I'll close it, this notion that these missed medical appointments, and the discipline that is imposed, on page 5, we address that point. White captains missed medical appointments, and Mr. Adu, by comparison, missed medical appointments, and he was suspended.
They were not comparably situated, and the other people got disciplined worse than him. What are you trying to prove?
Well, the latter point, Your Honor, with all due respect, they were not disciplined worse than him. They were disciplined disproportionately less than him. He got, and we point that out on page 5 of our brief when we talk about those numbers. And so I think the record clarifies that. That's not an accurate.
The record shows that they were differently situated than him. And what is your point on how are you saying they were disciplined worse than him?
They were disciplined worse than him because he was disciplined, for example, Your Honor, 84 hours and one suspension. Some of these individuals didn't have medical appointments for 7 years. If you were disciplined,
how long a suspension did they get?
The hours would be 300 to 580 hours.
Well, several times as great as what he got.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Several times as great as what he got, right?
Well, not really.
Okay. Other than mathematically, there's no other way to do that.
Well,
mathematically, they got more than he did.
Well, we point out the disparity, and it depends on how one applies the math. But we distinguish that, Your Honor, on page 13 of our brief. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case will be submitted.